Whether she's playing a mechanical bull-riding cowgirl, a factory worker, or a stay-at-home cancer-stricken mom, Deborah Winger brings a rare emotional intensity to every role that she takes on. Known for her fiery passion both on and off the screen, the 3-time Academy Award nominee was once one of the most sought-after actresses in Hollywood. Nowadays, she seems to be most passionate about writing, and she's here to talk about her first book, Undiscovered. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm delighted that it has brought Deborah Winger to this show. Hi, to a different kind of studio.
Yes.
Have you always written?
I want to answer that, but I have to respond to the opening and say that not all stay-at-home moms are cancer-stricken.
But, no, but you did play one.
No, I know. It just sounded like one whole phrase that I thought, oh, that's going to go
well,
nowhere.
One mechanical bull riding right. Cancer-stricken
mom. So now
mom.
Do I call you Len, Lenny? Because I've talked to so many authors that have done this show, and they all refer to you so lovingly, like Len, Lenny. Or should I call you Nerd, since nobody uses the second part of your name?
I call myself Leonard.
Leonard. Why do they take such license?
There are people, I'm sure, who call you Deb and Debbie, and
yes,
you probably say it's Deborah.
I assure somebody, if somebody calls me Deb or Debbie, they have no idea who I am.
So back to the other question. Have you always written?
Am I avoiding it? I have always written. And I haven't always written it down.
Uh-huh. You've written it in your head.
Yes.
Oh, I should have written that down. That was an interesting thought.
Yeah, I think that happened to me so often. And then, you know, as we all get to a certain age, we start to panic that, in fact, we're starting to forget when we just can't remember that we've always forgotten.
This book is part poetry, part memoir. How would you describe it?
Yeah, okay.
That, right?
We'll go with that today.
Are the chapters in the book personal stories you'd already written, or did you write them specifically for the book?
Yes, as well. I'm so being so hard on you. But it's true. Some of them were written, and David Outerbridge, who I worked with, who was a freelance editor, sort of helped me shape them. And some of them were written when I sort of understood that perhaps somebody else might read it someday. And
These were often written almost like diary entries.
No, they weren't journal entries or they weren't that sort of thing. I was actually trying to write in a way. I was trying to depersonalize it more. I think I would have depersonalized it more had not it gotten out of my hands a little sooner than, you know, I expected
it. And you wanted to depersonalize it because you felt at times this was a little intimate?
I just think it's fun to take the eye out of stuff, you know, and see how much resonates. Like, how, not when I say depersonalize, I don't mean it in a negative way or distancing way. I mean, how universal can our thinking get and how sort of essential and relevant can it get?
Well, I remember in school, teachers kept on telling me to take the eye out. I don't think people do that
no,
anymore.
No, they said, you're going to take an eye out, Lynn.
If you run around with that knife.
Don't run with that pencil.
But things have changed. And I would think that for an actor, taking the eye out is important as well.
Well, it's interesting because I think that, now we're only going to hear our eyes, but as an actor, you're constantly having to deal with the fact that you have an eye if you work in a certain way, which is to inhabit another eye. And so in a way, you're cohabitating. And I think that's why people can be very harsh with an actor that's in character, quote unquote, when they're not working or when shooting a film, and because it can get a little noisy and the conversations can get a little loud. But you, if you have your selfhood and it's intact and you're not, sometimes when you're really young, that can waver. Certainly I experienced that. But the eye is an important thing to deal with, either way, losing, keeping, dealing with.
You've said that you got caught up in Hollywood without really thinking about where you were going, like wanting a pony and being given a merry-go-round. And that's why you stop for a moment and reassess things?
Yeah, I think it was a natural. I don't think I put the brakes on. I think I sort of came to a, you know, I mean, if we want to take the metaphor of the horse, I was riding it and, you know, the horse got tired. But I always wanted to have something living. Oh, God, this metaphor is going to go bad, isn't it? Something when you're riding a horse and it's getting...
Well, you're allowed mixed metaphors when you're talking right. out loud. You're just not allowed them when you're writing them on the page.
This is just not midday radio talk where I'm going. But I would say that it was a natural cessation for me. It seems unnatural to people who still have an ambition that's separate from their self.
Well, you haven't dropped out of the film business.
Not
in fact,
all.
You're working on a Jonathan Demme movie right
That's
now, aren't you?
That's what I'm saying. Answering the question to me gets old, but people want to put it in certain terms. But I did what I did. I was going always towards something. I wasn't looking behind me. Nobody was chasing me.
But there are people who object. Gene Hackman told me recently on the show, in fact, that as much as he enjoys acting, he's pretty much retired because he just hates the business.
Yeah, I heard that. I was in the parking lot of a market sitting in my hot car listening to it. But
Were you surprised?
No.
Because
no.
You've said something similar over the years that you don't like the business side of the business.
I mean, I could quote, how many artists have talked about commerce and art and how, it's... You can shake it up for a while, but it always separates when you let it settle. And, you've made salad dressing. And so sometimes you just get tired of shaking it up all the time.
Well, it's the emulsifying that's the hard part. If we're doing the metaphors.
It's good that I'm the last interview because you might be a space cadet by the next. Living in metaphor can get really, really...
I'll think of a balsamic joke if you give me a little time.
Okay, aged well.
But what's so bad about the business side?
It's not that it's bad. It's just that it art and commerce, the mixture. I mean, I love great businessmen when I meet them because they're all about business, and it's I think it's fascinating when you're on the floor of the stock exchange. But to mix art and commerce can sometimes make you nauseous. It just can. And so you do it for a while, and then you stand back. And for me, it's been so fortifying to have something else come out, this book. To make something is really important. You want to be making things. And sometimes to work alone is nice.
Well, Gene Hackman is writing novels now. Will you want to try your hand at fiction?
Well, I think, a lot of life is fiction. So for me, it might feel the same. But, it depends on how real or unreal your life feels. I think if most people had what I had at 23, they would think their life was fiction. And so a lot of it was sorting it out for me. But yes, I would love to unhinge my brain now. And I think I might be able to go different places now that I have let myself do this.
Well, actually, actors seem to me to be better prepared for writing fiction than many because they've already become a lot of different characters. Right. And when you're creating a character, you can just sort of become that character when you're writing
it. Well, the text has always been so critical to me when I'm accepting a role. I mean, there have been many roles that I would have loved to have played, but the text didn't support it, And I know as theater actors will tell you, you can do Chekhov, you can go back to the text anytime you get in trouble. You can, most of the theater you're going to be doing, the text will always support that. Not so in the film business, and which is great. It's the reason why the next day you're shooting something different.
In the film business, because often the script is rather thin and they say, Deborah, you'll bring something to this.
You'll
make this character a real person.
But, then you get the luck of the draw, too. I mean, I was lucky enough to get some mighty scripts to be able to embody a character that I felt I had to live up to. I mean, Shadowlands was one of the most literate scripts I had read, and it was a challenge to me to equal that on the screen.
My guest is Deborah Winger. She's written a book. I was going to say her latest book, but it's her first book. It's called Undiscovered, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Why Undiscovered?
Well, I tell a short story about that word, but I'm sort of obsessed with the etymology of words as well. And I just always thought of undiscovered in a spiritual way when I was little. I thought of it as what was hidden, what we had to yet uncover. And it was ironic that I would find myself in a business that uses the word discovered to refer to Lana Turner and Schwab's, And so it became sort of a word for me, as bothered was this morning. Do you know that bother, the etymology of bother? It comes from caring. I love that because I was very bothered by the heat. So I started to look up the word bother, and it actually means that you care about something. So
wow. Right. Its roots are caring about it. In the old days, by the way, in the movies, your first role, it would have said, and introducing Deborah
right.
Winger. They don't do that anymore. After you were discovered, you would have been introduced.
Right. I wonder, you could be reintroduced, I guess.
You write that when you dream, you don't reach your destination. In most of your dreams?
Most of my dreams they don't have an end. I don't know. Maybe it's my taste in films, too. I never went for films that really have a beginning, middle, and end, and a car chase. But I do find that dreaming, when I wake up, I always feel that something was interrupted. I don't know. What do you feel about that? Is that true for you, or am I?
I have a hard time remembering dreams, and when I do remember them, it's usually because they're so emotionally powerful that
right.
I wake up with a start and
right. Yeah. So you feel that yeah. in a way it's in the middle or it's a vignette.
Yeah, I don't want it to end because right. if it ends, it usually will mean something horrible like the wrong person being elected president.
Well,
wait. We had that. I had that dream already.
I travel around for, you know, different campaigns through my life, and I always wake up startled in hotel rooms thinking the wrong person has gotten elected. But
now, you were the Hollywood It Girl for a while in the 1980s.
Hit Officer Girl or?
It.
I thought, wow, I'm being accused of something else.
No car chases. Officer and a Gentleman, Terms of Endearment. But you turned down some pretty plum roles. Broadcast News, Fatal Attraction.
We have to define turning down, first of all. I had things happening, because I really want to get this out of the,
good.
First of all, if you look at the years that some of these films that just you read it over and over that I turned something down, I was actually doing something else.
Uh-huh.
So you can only be in one place at one time.
So you had to choose whether you want to be in this movie or that movie.
Yeah, they never talk about the one you did. My son noticed the other day that they were giving a statistic on the radio. They said 1 out of 3 high school kids are having sex. He said, why don't they say 2 out of 3 or not? So I will say this to you. You know, I did not do 5 films, but I did do 5 others.
Right.
But anyway, I never worked as much as the average bear. I always thought one film a year was plenty, and if one film every 2 years. So I could only do so much. And a lot of the time, as we said, the film was successful for a myriad of reasons, but when I read the text, it didn't reflect where I wanted to go right then. But it isn't, you know, because the film is successful is not a reason to be in it.
Do you think that the fact that you've thought about writing over the years, and I'm sure you wrote now and then even back then, that you had a different sense of that text?
I think that it has grown over the years, and certainly knowing authors and writers and reading more. In my life, I had a public school education in the most overcrowded years of Southern California. So I was one. We had 60 to 65 kids in every class in my high school. That's correct. Check it out. In the early 70s, it's still on the records as being one of the most overcrowded time for public schools, and it was in Southern California in those years. And that's exactly when I was there. And I was a W. So we were sat in alphabetical order, so you know where I was. So I'm not, you know, not to make a lot of excuses, but I didn't have a hearty early, you know, school education. And so a lot of my learning came later, and I was self-taught and read, and hence my mispronunciations of things, because when you learn from books, you often mispronounce things.
I remember thinking M-I-S-L-E-D was misled.
Well, that's sophisticated. I love it, Leonard. You grew up in Brooklyn, didn't you?
In crowded classrooms.
But I mean, you obviously that's a pretty. I'm not even going to tell you some of the things I mispronounced, but I will say that the text became important to me because I would be looking at it as 7 months of my life. Basically, I took. In those days, not to make it sound too ancient, 3 months to prepare. You usually knew a few months in advance that you were doing a film, and so I was a research freak. I loved research. It was a process, and I loved the process. And so if I was going to devote that much time to something, I really wanted to learn something because it was where I was in my life.
I've always wondered about that. I've spoken to a number of actors. Vanessa Redgrave says she researches everything. Michael Chabon says, I don't research anything. They give me the script, I learn the script, and I find the character in the script.
Yeah. No, I'm research free.
Even if it's Chekhov?
Always, especially if, I mean, you know, you want to know what disease you're dying of if you're dying, right?
Deborah Winger's book, Undiscovered, is published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation.
That was a bad note to finish on.
We'll take a break. We'll be back. We'll be able to recoup.
Okay.
We're back with Deborah Winger. She's written a book called Undiscovered. It is published by Simon & Schuster. And,
could you clear up a family argument
sure.
for me? Was that woman's voice automated? Is that a computer voice?
No, that is not.
That's a real woman that pronounces all those letters, all those consonants. That's a real woman.
All those consonants and vowels as well.
I need to speak with her. You're an actress.
Why?
I just need to speak with her. I'm not ready to put my money down on that.
You grew up in Southern California.
Partial.
You learned how to speak correctly.
No, oh, I didn't.
You didn't?
I still say cuz. And I say member instead of remember. I don't speak.
Now, how do you write? Do you write on a computer or longhand?
I'm lucky if I remember to bring implements where I go when I write because I never my husband is amazing at going into a room and saying I'm going to write and sitting down his typewriter and writing because he writes on a typewriter. And I'm completely envious of that ability, like a craft. I have to be doing something else, you know. It's great if I can cane a few dozen chairs, you know, and then happen to have like a pad of paper but not really admit that it's there. Like, oh, great.
You have to trick yourself into writing?
Yes.
So do you think you'll be doing more writing?
Well, you know, as long as I don't have a deadline. I think that although I am working on a deadline right now, which I've never done before, and I know now where it got its name. So.
Are you writing another book?
Right now I'm writing an article for a newspaper, so we'll see how that goes.
How did you get into acting? I know that you lived in a kibbutz in Israel and served in the Israeli army for a while.
Yeah, no
internet, not
internet, let's work.
Another
really,
one of those.
Yeah, we're here. This is, you know, we need to come up with a word that's like spam, but here's my idea about what that word would mean. It's the equal to a snowball that starts out really, really small and you roll it down a hill and by the end it's a boulder. The internet is that. You can start with a little pebble and it just gets repeated or picked up by how many websites and it is not only the truth, but it's really a big truth. No, I was on a tour that millions of children have gone on and go through the state of Israel and visit a kibbutz and visit army training and see how an Israeli child grows up.
That was
it. Period.
Well,
end of subject.
No, I understand because there's a Wikipedia entry for me, and I read it, and it had some of it was absolutely true, and some of it was so wrong,
right.
Including having me married.
Oh.
Did you go in and change it?
Because people ask me that all the time. I never would dare because, you know, Jack Nicholson taught me early on, if you deny one thing, everything you don't deny is automatically true. So you better not deny that one thing. So I deny nothing.
Did you have any to play any role in the design of this book? Because the cover has you turning your back to us in this gorgeous setting.
Oh, yeah,
that's
a picture that we took, yes. My friend Sally Davies took the actual photograph, and I'm on the land where I love, out in the country. And yes, it's
standing
my
in an
dress,
open door of a wrecked building.
Yes, a friend of ours, Earl Crum, put that door up for me that day, and my husband sort of had this vision of a door in an open field, and it sort of supported a reoccurring theme that I have where I collect doors and plant them in the forest. So it was a collective hypnosis we were all in. And Philippe Petit, who did the illustrations for the book, also had a fascination with doors, portals, gates. And we had spoke about it one New Year's Eve, and that's how it came to be that we collaborated on the ideas for the drawings. And then he went away and drew these amazing doorways, portals.
But the message that I get here is that you feel like you're walking through a door into something else.
A door, a portal, a gate. It always takes on a different look. But I would say that if you're living in metaphor, which I think for me saves me a lot.
Is that in Westchester, metaphor?
No, that's up in the Catskills. That's Sullivan County, New York, up where they want to drill for gas, but that's another show. I would say that I just have visuals that help me. And when I want to wake up in a moment, as the moment that you pass through the middle on a high wire, you go to the left, you go to the right, but the middle is all that really exists. I would say that the actual passing through of any gateway or portal or the gate to a garden or a door to a house is a moment and an opportunity to wake up. So that's why I chose it. And it sounds like a high school essay.
Do you feel like you walk through many doors? For example, were there films that you were in where you walked through a door that changed everything?
Many that you're looking for the exit as soon as you...
Yeah. But I would assume an officer and a gentleman was like walking through a major door into something
That ends with walking out of a door. I would say that they're transformations. You know, they're opportunities. And I think every film that I was ever in, including... You know, the one that I have just done with Jonathan Demme was definitely sort of a passage. And some of them are long hallways and some of them are, you don't want me to go
in. Here we go.
They're all in the book, though. There's a drawing of each one that I've ever imagined, and Philippe as well.
Now, you worked with some pretty great directors.
Yes.
Was that one of the things that you considered when you were thinking about taking a role?
Absolutely. I mean, if you were going to move in with someone for 4 months, you might really think about it, you know. Maybe if it's 2 weeks, maybe.
but that doesn't always work out with a co-star, and I've heard many cases where we see this incredible chemistry on the screen, and then we learn later that they hated each other.
I never tried to control that. I mean, there were actors and there are actors that I would love to work with, but I always felt that should be the director's vision. It's his picture that he's painting. I don't want to come in and say, you know, hire so-and-so. And that's why I never really produced or became an actress with an umbrella development company, because I thought, well, what director would want to work for an actor that's going to call the shots? You know, even
Kirk Douglas did very nicely producing.
No, I mean, some people I think it did work for, but for me and for, I think for women, sometimes that was difficult. I mean, I'm sure you could cite very many examples of how it worked. I didn't believe that that was what I wanted to do, although theater started that way. I mean, in the days of Stanislavski, the actors produced. And I think if you give the director free rein, then yes, it works that way. But not if you're trying to control those aspects.
Of course, Stanislavski also had Chekhov writing for him.
That's
that was
correct.
A pretty good time.
Hence the text.
After Urban Cowboy, An Officer and a Gentleman, many people viewed you as a sex object. Did that make you feel uncomfortable?
Love being a sex object.
Oh, did you?
Especially at home. No, I'm.
Do you just simply say to your husband, "Well, you know, if you don't think I'm a sex object, here's a DVD."
I don't have to say anything to my husband ever. Let's just leave it at that. But
good for him and good for you.
Which I still will say that, you know, all this talk with about aging and women. I'm sitting here talking to you, so we probably won't go to that subject. But the minute I sit down with a woman, they want to talk about aging and what are you going to do to your face and what have people said to you about your face. And I say, you know, women, we are our own worst enemies. No man that loves you. My husband wakes up in the morning because you're beautiful. I love you. I'm not going to go out and get cut. It's as simple as that. So I feel
very fortunate. Well, it is often obvious. I've seen some pretty wealthy women who could afford the best plastic surgery who really it was obvious that they'd had work done.
Well, I think that is the desired effect.
So to look like you've had work done?
You're looking at it through something that wants to look natural, but I'm not sure that that's the aesthetic there. But I just say, give them a ticket. It's like if before you have an abortion, if you're underage, you have to go for counseling, right? So before you have a facelift, let's give a ticket to travel somewhere, get out in the world a little bit, see what's going on. And if you still want it and you want to spend your money that way, okay.
Meanwhile, for a lot of actresses, once they get past a certain age, they wind up doing TV. Is that what's left for actresses who
Well, I'm sure a lot of people that create wonderful shows would not want to be thinking of themselves as what's left. Because I'm sure that a lot of these shows are good. I've never had the patience to sit in front of a television set. It's not about the television so much as my nature. So I don't know those shows that well. There have been times in the past when I got hooked on a show and watched it, mostly if they made me laugh. Mm-hmm. I like to laugh at television. And I like to get news from television and sports. So that's how I use television. I probably won't be the most knowledgeable person to answer that.
Well, you said that when you were little, someone told you that when you age, you turn into the person you were all your life. Do you still believe that?
Well, so far, I think so. But, you know, I'm still looking. I don't want to be the authority on aging. God, no.
I'm not asking about getting old. Yeah. You look great.
I know, but I'm saying that I think
don't
my
have
friend,
that surgery, Deborah.
My friend Mary Jane, who's 82, and is just, she's amazing to me. I can't stop looking at her. But does she look like a young woman? No. Does she look her age? No. There's just an agelessness that happens at a certain time that I'm really looking forward to.
Deborah Winger will be speaking with Janet Maslin tonight at 6:30 at the Time Center, and she'll be speaking with her husband, Arliss Howard, at the 92nd Street Y on June 30th at 8:15. If you want to buy tickets to either of those, go to our show page at WNYC.org. And there's also the book, Undiscovered, which is published by Simon & Schuster, all of which makes me very happy that Deborah Winger stopped by to talk with me today.
Thank you, Lenny Nerd.